Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Pentagon has released its list of more than 150 proposed base closings. 33 major bases are on it, including Cannon Air Force Base in New Mexico, the Naval Station in Texas, and Ellsworth Air Force Base in South Dakota, home to half the nation's fleet of aircraft and South Dakota's second largest employer. New England took a big hit, too. The submarine base in New London, Connecticut, and Otis Air Force Base on Cape Cod, both slated for closure. We'll have more on this story later in the program, and we'll speak with a mayor who says she'll fight the Pentagon's plan to close the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard that's straddling Maine and New Hampshire. But first, on this Friday, there is no rest for U.S. soldiers trying to quell the insurgency in Iraq. In Baghdad, two explosions targeted American patrols. Reportedly, no one was seriously injured. Yesterday, Iraqis, frustrated after a deadly car bombing, threw stones at U.S. forces and Iraqi police. And some U.S. troops have paid a heavy price along the border with Syria. A Washington Post correspondent, embedded with Marines there, reports that in the space of a few days this week, everyone in an entire Marine Corps squad was either killed or wounded. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Washington Post reporter Jonathan Feiner. Jonathan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan, it was your colleague, Ellen Nickmeyer, who was embedded with these troops as they moved towards the Syrian border to try to cut off insurgents crossing over. She's been doing some incredible reporting. Earlier this week, she told the story of the squad that was ambushed at a house in one town in western Iraq. Yesterday, she reported how that same squad of Marines was basically taken out as a fighting force, a squad of, 15 to 20 troops. What happened?
Well, they were proceeding in a convoy, which is one of the more dangerous activities you can do as a civilian or a soldier in this country. And one of the vehicles in the convoy, somewhere towards the rear, struck an improvised explosive device, or that device was detonated by someone remotely. And it ended up engulfing the vehicle in flames, killing four Marines and wounding at least 10 others.
This was after the same squad had just the day before lost two squad members who were killed and five wounded in an ambush in another town. Now these losses, 100% casualties in the squad?
That's right. I think 100% of the people in the squad were either killed or wounded in the 2 days of the operation.
And the squad is one of three in the platoon. Ellen reports the platoon sustained 60% casualties. And she had just been in the vehicle that blew up. She had transferred to another vehicle in the convoy. So the rest of the convoy watched as that vehicle blew up.
Yes, that's right. She had been interviewing some of the Marines who were in the vehicle that was eventually struck, switched to another vehicle, and from what she described, at that point, as soon as the vehicle exploded, Marines who were traveling the other parts of the convoy rushed to it and tried to pull some of the Marines who were trapped inside out.
Well, so now this platoon is without an entire squad. The military is saying today that the fighting seems to have quieted down in that part of Iraq. What exactly are they saying?
Well, what the Marines spokespeople that we've talked to out in western Iraq have said is that a lot of the insurgents who were standing and fighting them for a few days have withdrawn into some of the villages along the Syrian border and are hiding. So what the Marines are doing now is going around interviewing locals, trying to gather intelligence, and then using that information to guide their operations.
I know you're in close contact with Ellen. What is the mood of that group of troops who've just lost so many fellow soldiers?
Well, I mean, I would imagine that it's very somber. It's not the kind of the experience that anyone going into an operation like this wants to encounter. We should say that overall it's been a fairly low casualty operation for the Marines who are out there. It's a group of more than 1,000, and as far as we know, there have been only a handful who have been killed and perhaps two dozen who have been wounded. But at the same time, for that group, I can only imagine what must be going through their minds.
Well, in the meantime, in Baghdad, the violence seems to have gotten so much worse. What is your sense of what's happening in Baghdad? The U.S. military acknowledges 70 attacks a day, up from 30 or 40 a few months ago.
Yes, that's 70 across the country, but Baghdad has been hit particularly hard in the last couple of weeks as the government has named its cabinet and tried to consolidate its hold on power. This is the first democratically elected government in the country's history, and insurgents seem to have sort of taken advantage of this period of some confusion and transition to launch an increasingly bloody series of attacks.
Do you expect to feel the effect of the fighting up on the border? In other words, if they are stopping the insurgents, at the cost of a lot of U.S. lives, but if they're stopping the insurgents from coming across that border, do you expect to have more quiet in Baghdad?
Well, the theory that some people offer is that because the insurgents are being targeted out in the West, some others are trying to take advantage of the fact that U.S. military attention is focused there to launch attacks in other parts of the country. We saw that happen when the U.S. invaded Fallujah back in November. There was an increase in attacks in certain other cities while attention was focused there. So that's certainly been one concern, because attacks certainly have escalated as the Marines have conducted their operation.
Jonathan Feiner, foreign correspondent for The Washington Post, speaking to us from Baghdad. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
For the last couple of years, a genocide has been unfolding in the Darfur region of Sudan. It has figured prominently in the world's news coverage from time to time. It's been the topic of debate in the United Nations. And yet, the world just doesn't seem to be able to muster enough outrage to actually do something to stop it. One of the voices shouting loud and long about the Darfur crisis is New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, and he joins us from New York. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Nick, what day is it?
It's day 123 of the president's silence on Darfur.
We're referring, of course, to something you mentioned in a column recently, that you were going to count the days the president has been silent on this issue. In that same column, you accused President Bush of actively working to stop Congress from doing something about the Darfur killings. Could you explain that?
Yeah, that's what I find most frustrating. You know, it's not just passivity in the face of genocide. It's that when Congress actually does finally, belatedly muster the gumption to pass the Darfur Accountability Act, which would, for the first time, you know, press the U.S. to take some steps against it, then the Bush administration put strong pressure on Republican leaders in the Congress to actually take it out of the bill before passage.
Why?
I think there are a few things going on. I think one is that the president feels very heavily invested in the North-South peace process in Sudan, and feels, I think, justifiably that this is a very important thing that he accomplished, and he doesn't want the Darfur mess to cause problems for the North-South peace process. And the other thing is that we've been building up a real intelligence relationship between the CIA and intelligence officials in Sudan, and I think he doesn't want to jeopardize that.
And that's, of course, part of the war on terrorism.
That's right. And you know, both are legitimate things to be concerned about. On the other hand, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have already died because of our reticence for these kinds of reasons. And if we continue to adopt the same approach, there are going to be hundreds of thousands more who are going to die because of it.
Well, but another reason might be that President Bush's father famously became involved in Somalia, and it was just a mess.
There are legitimate reasons to not want to have U.S. troops go there. And in fact, I think that would be a mistake. I think that given the mood in the Arab world, for U.S. or any Western troops to go there would be a problem. But that logic does not apply to, for example, encouraging the African Union and providing logistical support to the African Union to play a greater role in security there. It wouldn't apply to establishing a no-fly zone with NATO support in Darfur. And so there are steps that we can take that I think would involve pretty minimal risk, and there is some prospect that they would make a substantial difference. And I think we're going to look back with really, you know, tremendous embarrassment and sadness years from now that this unfolded and we did nothing at all about it.
Well, in fact, you've compared the U.S. government's lack of intervention in Darfur with its looking the other way when Turkey was massacring Armenians or Nazis early on killing Jews. You've made that comparison.
Yeah, and I mean, genocide is always a messy, difficult process, and there are never any neat solutions. There weren't during the Armenian genocide, there weren't during the Jewish genocide, and they're not now. But one of the lessons of history is simply that speaking out forcefully does make a difference. And in fact, when President Bush has pressed the issue, when Congress has pressed the issue, then indeed the level of killing in Darfur does subside. And it was striking that one of the bloodiest months was January, after the tsunami in Asia had distracted people from Darfur.
Yeah. Well, you were counting the days for President Bush, but he is not your only concern. You say there are others who could be raising their voices. The American media, the Muslim world.
Absolutely. I mean, it would make a huge difference if other Arab countries, and especially Egypt, were to begin to put pressure on Sudan. And that certainly, I mean, one can understand to some degree why Arab Muslims end up siding with Arabs over non-Arab Muslims. But Pakistan played a crucial and really unfortunate role in supporting the Arab government in Sudan, you know, rather than the victims who were also Muslims. And, of course, the Pakistanis are not Arabs. I mean, I think there's been, throughout the Muslim world, kind of an instinctive sense that, you know, the U.S. is criticizing it, Sudan is a Muslim government, therefore we're going to side with Sudan.
What about the American media?
I wish we had done a better job on this, and there have been some people who've done a great job. But I think that we tend to complain that the Bush administration can't, you know, walk and chew gum at the same time, that it's so focused on Iraq that it hasn't paid enough attention to other problems around the world. And that's true, but I think it's also true of those of us in the media as well, that we've been so focused on Iraq that we haven't paid adequate attention to what has gone on in other places, and Darfur is the biggest and most lethal example of that.
Well, and as you've pointed out, both the president and the press were able to take a good deal of time and focus off of Iraq to cover the Terry Schiavo case.
Yeah, and, you know, this is a really, I mean, if you're going to commit genocide, then a place like Darfur is the place to do it and get away with it. This is an incredibly remote area. Sudan doesn't allow people inside it. You have to sneak in from Chad, which is dangerous, and just it's really difficult to get to. And, you know, so there are excuses one can make, but you know that if the Michael Jackson trial were being held in Darfur, then, you know, every network would figure out a way of being there every day and getting coverage all over.
Well, we've spoken of the American government, the American media, the world's Muslims. What about the American people?
The Darfur genocide has aroused two particular groups. One is the American Jewish community, and the Jewish community was not early on the issue. The Christian right actually was very attuned to Sudan right from the beginning, because in the past Sudan had been busy killing Christians. But then about a year ago, synagogues around the country began to raise the issue and began to argue that, yeah, that, you know, never again doesn't just refer to an anti-Semitic leader, you know, rising in Germany. It has a much broader meaning, that we don't tolerate this kind of racial hatred and slaughter somewhere else in the world. The other community that's been very active has been university students, and you know, around the country, campus after campus, they've been pushing the issue with, you know, enormous campaigns. You know, it redeems my faith in the country to some degree every time I go on a campus and, you know, see signs about Darfur and divestment campaigns and fundraising efforts to send money to save lives there, that kind of thing.
Well, when we return, we're going to have more with you, more with columnist Nicholas Kristof of The New York Times. We'll find out how his readers are responding to his columns. Also, later in the program, the Pentagon announced its list of base closures, reaction pouring in from elected officials. We'll have more on that. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been speaking with New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof about the genocide in Darfur and his frustrations about what the world is not doing to stop it. And Nick, Samantha Powers at Harvard University's Kennedy School has spoken eloquently about genocide in general and Darfur in particular. This week, she called on universities to divest their portfolios of companies that have dealings with Sudan. Do you think that will help?
Yeah. I must say that I'm generally a skeptic about divestment, and I generally firmly believe in, you know, economic engagement. This is, I think, one case where divestment does make sense, and, you know, partly that's because what we need most urgently in Darfur is simply to raise the issue and make people care about it. And as long as one's shining a little bit of a flashlight on Darfur, then the deaths don't stop, but they do diminish.
And those deaths, the last time we checked, were horrific. Children being thrown onto bonfires, whole villages being torched, women having to go out to get water or wood and being raped in order to be impregnated by the Janjaweed, who would want to bring more Arabs into the region. Now, you report that there's a new twist on the rapes of women. They're being arrested?
A lot of these women who have been raped obviously end up pregnant. Typically, they are either unmarried or their husband has been killed, and then those who were still left in Sudan, unless they can pay a bribe to the local police, have frequently been arrested for adultery, taken to a jail, made into kind of a slave labor for the local police, and they haven't been executed, but they have been just treated atrociously.
Yeah. You wrote in March about an American, a former Marine captain who was an advisor for the African Union monitoring team, who was shocked by the murder that he saw, but also by the Janjaweed's admission that they were committing these atrocities and that they were going to keep doing it. Can you tell us a little of what he saw and a little more of what he heard from the Janjaweed?
Yeah. His role working for the African Union was to go around and to try to stop the killings or at least monitor them. And he was taken aback when the Janjaweed would tell him, look, unless this problem is resolved, we're going to be wiping out these five villages. And, you know, in fact, typically they would. But one of the things that Brian Steidel, this young American, emphasized was that a really very modest presence of African Union forces was often enough to protect a village. The Janjaweed are bullies. They're poorly armed. And if you just have a few dozen international troops, then often they can prevent, a slaughter. And that's the tragedy in this, that I think there's a perception in America that, terrible things go on in Africa. It's too bad, but there's really nothing we can do. And in fact, there are things that we can do.
Nick Kristof, we started off by saying you've made a commitment to count the days until President Bush brings up Darfur again. How long will you count? How long will you keep, and how long will your editors let you keep bringing this issue back into your columns?
I don't know. I must say that, it's been strange as a columnist because normally we, bounce around from issue to issue. I wouldn't go, again to the same capital, twice in close succession. But I've now been to Darfur three times in the last year and planning another trip now. It feels strange in terms of my own role. But on the other hand, this is, I think, a case where journalism can make a huge difference by forcing people to pay more attention to something that is really ugly. The best way to stop is indeed to kind of galvanize people about it. There's a book actually that just recently came out about the New York Times and the Holocaust, and we did a lousy job covering that. The American press generally did.
Covering the Holocaust.
During the Holocaust. In general, the American news media have done a lousy job in one genocide after another, and that's because, their public hasn't been energized about it. But I think that if you look back, at history, then one of the lessons is that we should be a little more aggressive about trying to cover these kinds of things and that we can make a real difference when we do.
Nicholas Kristof, you've done this before. You've taken up causes. There were some young women, I believe, in Cambodia working as sex slaves. You went back several times. You gave your readers links to things that they could do. Wasn't there another column where you actually heard from someone, a gentleman who read your column on Darfur and pretty much said, I can't stand this. I can't stand hearing this. Here's a check.
This man in New York, this reader who came into my office one day and, he said he wanted to write a check. Initially, he was talking about $1 million for Darfur and kind of, who would it be useful to give it to? And I suggested Doctors Without Borders. And he ended up writing them a check for $500,000.
Well, so no wonder you keep writing about this.
Well, in the column business, I always feel kind of torn between writing about issues that are already on the agenda and that people care passionately about versus issues that nobody cares about at all, but that you feel that just by the process of, writing about it and putting it on some of the most valuable real estate in America, which is the New York Times op-ed page, that, you know, maybe one can begin to help put things a little bit on the agenda. But, I mean, it's been very satisfying at one level to see the response to what I've written about Darfur and what other people have written about Darfur. I mean, the word Darfur is now kind of a household word around America, whereas nobody had heard about it when I first went there. On the other hand, it is so dispiriting that everybody now knows about Darfur. The president has called it genocide, and yet we're continuing to do nothing and to allow a genocide to unfold, even as we know exactly what is going on.
Nicholas Kristof, his column appears in the New York Times. Nick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you can get links to Nicholas Kristof's columns on Darfur by going to our website, here-now.org. And this quick program note, next week on Here and Now, are you investing for the future? Well, we'll look at the retirement portfolios of some Nobel Prize-winning economists, and guess what? They haven't done that well. So how will the non-economists do? Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Pentagon wants to shutter 33 major military bases across the country. The Defense Department made the announcement today, also calling for more than 100 smaller installations to be closed. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld drafted the plan, saying it would save the military nearly $50 billion over 20 years. Well, joining us on the line with more is Chris Hellman, an expert on military base closings at the Arms Control Center in Washington, D.C. Chris, put this in perspective for us. How significant is today's announcement?
Well, it's something that the Pentagon has been attempting to do for about the last decade. They consider this to be essential, not just from a cost-saving standpoint, but also as being part of their effort to transform themselves to a 21st century force by moving troops around and relocating them in a way that they feel will better support the strategic mission for the 21st century.
Well, you've seen the list. Just give us a sense. If you could hopscotch around the country for a minute and tell us where are some of the closings, where's the biggest impact?
Well, I think the region of the country that's going to end up being the biggest loser is New England and the northern tier states. While you're seeing at least stability or an increase along the southern tier and towards the Pacific Ocean, and this is a reflection of the military's reorientation away from its Cold War status and towards the threats it sees in the future, and a reorientation away from Europe and towards the Pacific.
And we're going to hear some reaction to that, by the way, in a moment. But there have been arguments that this isn't the right time to downsize the military because of the war on terrorism.
Well, this isn't a downsizing of the military. The military itself is staying roughly the same size. What this is a downsizing of the infrastructure that supports it, which the Pentagon has asserted in recent years is roughly 25% above what they need. They've revamped that figure, but I think it's clear in the minds of everybody that we're currently carrying more infrastructure than we need. So what they're doing is shedding some excess costs while maintaining the military at its current size.
Could you tell us a little more about those restructuring plans?
Well, one of the things that you're seeing is an emphasis on what the military refers to as jointness, which is better operations between the military services, the Army working more closely, for instance, with, say, the Air Force. The understanding that if this is something that you want to do on the battlefield, that there are ways to enhance that capability by the way you station your troops. And again, we're seeing in recent years a growing concern about our interests in the Pacific, while the traditional concern about Europe and vis-a-vis the Soviet Union has been radically reduced over the last decade.
Well, Chris, with just the minute and a half we have left with you, in the meantime, with these closings or suggested closing, the Pentagon says 29,000 military and civilian jobs will be lost. Many of them will be moving out of towns. You've worked with redeveloping past bases that have been shut down. Give some advice to a town that's just heard that a base is moving.
Well, the first thing you have to do is at some point you're going to have to recognize that the battle is over and start working on what you want to do next. And secondly, you have to start thinking very broadly about your facility, not just as a military base, but as an asset. and what types of things you can use it to do to either A, attract new work, or B, enhance the quality of life in your community. While this issue usually focuses on centers on job creation and job loss, the fact of the matter is these resources could do other things to enhance a community's quality of life, in addition to being an engine for economic growth.
In fact, you worked with the Philadelphia Naval Shipyard, and it did not go as well as you wanted because the community wouldn't give up on the idea of rebuilding ships.
Right, that was part of the problem. If you look at the commercial market for shipbuilding, the United States is not an active participant in that. And the idea of building commercial shipping, while attractive, really was a non-starter, and it effectively stymied redevelopment efforts in the community.
Well, as we're going to hear, not everyone agrees with your thinking on this. Chris Hellman, an expert on military base closing, he works at the Arms Control Center in Washington, D.C., and has had boots on the ground on this issue. Chris, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Well, one of the bases the military wants to close is the historic Portsmouth Naval Yard. It's a naval shipyard, and it's an over 200-year-old base which straddles New Hampshire and Maine and specializes in maintaining nuclear submarines. About 4,300 civilian workers will lose their jobs if it's closed. It creates a huge economic impact on the area, more than 10 years after the area lost the Pease Air Force Base. Well, joining us on the line to talk about today's announcement is the mayor of Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Evelyn Searle. Mayor, how are you?
We're all kind of down in the dumps here today.
Well, I understand, Mayor Searle, that when you heard the news that Portsmouth Naval Yard was on the list to be closed, you invoked the saying of a famous naval hero, John Paul Jones. What'd you say?
I sure do. We have not yet begun to fight.
Well, what do you plan to do?
What I'm going to try this time, I'm going to try a little bit different idea. The families and the workers, because they're the ones that are being devastated. I had a family come in yesterday. A mother with six children and her husband, and he works on the Navy Yard. And they said to me, what are we going to do? We're going to lose our home, and it's just devastating to us, mentally, physically, and every other thing. I'm trying to get people, and that's what I'm going to concentrate on this time, is personal letters from families. I think that will cover a lot more territory than me sending letters, you know?
Have the letters come from the workers. But Mayor, some say the base is no longer needed. It was designed to counter a Cold War threat that no longer exists.
I don't agree to that at all. Not in these troublesome times. It makes us feel unsafe if they talk that, because right now we have a safety blanket all around us. And when we lost Pease, we lost that side of it.
Pease Air Force, right.
Yes, and now if we lose the base, it isn't just submarines there. We have three huge Coast Guard cutters.
Well, Mayor Searle, in addition, the security of a job. 2,000 civilian jobs were held by New Hampshire residents at the base. Almost 1,300 non-shipyard jobs would be lost if the shipyard was eliminated. What happens in a town when those wages are removed?
Well, I'll tell you, when they closed the air base, the school system came down to practically nothing. We had to lay off teachers, all of that.
We understand that bankers in particular become nervous because without those wages being spent on things, there's not enough money for car loans, home loans.
That's right.
How else do you expect it might impact your town?
It will hurt us deeply. Not only with the school system, but the real estate that will be put on the market. The downtown businesses that, you know, we've worked very hard for them to flourish. It is going to affect us, and it's going to affect us deeply.
Mrs. Mayor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Evelyn Searle is mayor of Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Well, still to come, 86-year-old Alan Lanham puts down his baton after conducting the Masterworks Chorale for 53 years. You're listening to Here and Now. galaxy, it's 5 days before the final Star Wars movie, Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, comes out. And 300 people are already waiting at Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood, where all the Star Wars movies have premiered. The problem is, the new one won't open there. That movie is scheduled to open at a new theater a few blocks away, so on opening night, these fans, many of them in costume, will march over to the other theater. The group is documenting its activities at lineingup.net, and you can reach a fan at a payphone in front of the theater. Also, when we called, Otis Chambliss picked up. Otis, how many hours have you been in line?
I've got about 100 because we can take time out. We have a sign-in and sign-out sheet, so we can come and go. If you have a job, if you have other necessities you need to take care of, you don't by any means have to stay here the full 6 weeks.
Tell me about this, because this is fan organized. It's a log in, log out, and you also can contribute to the line, make a donation of $50, correct?
That is correct.
To a children's charity?
It goes to a children's charity for children that are underprivileged.
Well, now tell us about the log in, log out. Who runs it?
We all kind of maintain it. If I sign out, then someone initials it for me, and we kind of all maintain a really excellent level of respect for each other.
Well, Otis, tell us, what are you doing? Tell us what's going on the line.
We get a lot of passerbys that ask us questions about why we're here and what we're doing. It's usually pretty low-key during the day. It's at the nighttime when it kind of fuels up. We've had projectors out here where we project onto a wall and we'll watch like Star Wars or other movies. There's a setup for building your own Jedi robe. There, you buy your fabric and pretty much there's sewing machines and whatnot and everything you need.
Yeah.
Build your own lifesavers. There's all types of activities.
And computers, laptops, cell phones.
Yeah, we've got a live webcam. We've got wireless internet. Just about everything.
I got to ask you, Otis, what about your job?
Well, mine works out pretty decent because I'm a school teacher, so I can schedule off my time to fit right in when I need the time.
I'm sure your pupils' parents will be thrilled to hear that. You're just not
well,
showing
see,
up.
Because I teach little kids, they don't mind, because all the things I get here, I can
tell them.
Incorporate into the classroom.
Yeah, they probably love it. And we understand that within this community, there are subdivisions. For instance, there are groups who don't want to hear anything about the new movie at all. What are they called? Spoiler-free groups.
Well, what that actually is we have three different colors. We have red, who are absolutely spoiler-free. They want to know nothing. There's people out here that don't even actually know that it's Revenge of the Sith.
No.
They only think it's Episode 3.
Mm-hmm.
There's blue that are pretty much in the middle, and they are able to see only official licensed trailers. And then there's green, which I am, which actually we know about everything. I've read the script.
You've read the script.
Yeah.
So no big surprise for you.
And none at all.
Otis, what is so compelling about this that you would stand on this line? What is it about this movie?
Well, for me, I'm completing the life circle. There was the very first movie. My father took me to it. I barely remember it when I first saw it, but it was the actual first movie I ever saw. And now I'm going to it as an adult on my own, and it'll be completing a circle 30 years for me.
Right. Are you at all worried that it might let you down?
Oh, no. Because I've read it, it's going to be an excellent movie. I'm already prepared for the very positive backlash. It's going to be a terrific movie.
Well, and you'll be the one mouthing along the lines, the only
exactly.
one at the premiere.
Exactly.
But Otis,
I know a lot of the dialogue. That's absolutely right.
Well, actually, what happens? How did you read the script?
Well, I got ways of getting things.
I guess so.
I have a few friends in different places.
I take it back because millions of people just gasped and said, don't tell us. So don't tell us what happens. But tell me this. What's going to happen on the night that it premieres?
We're going to move en masse. And in all actuality, it's been rumored that we're going to have an official escort with stormtroopers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Otis, have a good time till then.
Thank you.
And thank you.
Thanks, now.
Okay, now everybody's gone. So tell me what happens.
Oh,
no,
what?
Don't say it. Don't say it.
I can tell you.
No, don't. I don't want to know.
I can actually tell you who has the very last line in the movie.
Okay, tell me that.
C-3PO.
Okay.
And it's on the
no.
same place where he...
No! No! Otis, goodbye.
Bye.
Stay with us. More ahead, here and now.
Free. and a four and a one.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Last fall, members of the Massachusetts-based Masterworks Chorale rehearsed for their fall performance of Bach's Magnificat and Haydn's Mass in D minor, under the baton of 86-year-old Alan Lanham, who has been at the helm of this all-amateur choir for over 53 years.
A little too heavy. Lighten it up a little bit. Other than that, it was better. Start, please.
The purpose of this rehearsal is to try and get them to phrase a sense of working with afterbeat phrasing.
What does that mean, afterbeat phrasing?
Well, usually you think of one and two, three and four, and the way Bach writes, it's one ta da da di pi di 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 pa da da da. He leaves the beat and goes to the next beat, and so on and so forth.
This just gives the impression of being totally emotionally out of control, but not being that. Although it must have that kind of exhilaration. It's a gorgeous figure that he uses there anyway. Sicute herati, not sicute herati, sicute herati. And a one.
A consummate teacher as well as conductor, Alan taught at Boston University for three decades and has probably led these pieces over a dozen times. But he approached this rehearsal as if it was his first. In fact, this would mark the beginning of Alan's last season as full-time conductor of Masterworks. When we spoke, he had just announced his retirement. Tomorrow night, he'll conduct his last concert, Brahms' Requiem, followed by a tribute. So we decided to bring you once again our visit with Alan Lanham as he prepares for a concert and reflects on a life immersed in the masterpieces as conductor of Masterworks.
One of the greatest I ever had chance to conduct was the Beethoven Missa Solemnis. Of course, we're doing the Brahms, and that is moving in a different kind of way.
Well, and then, of course, there's the crowd pleaser, Carmina Burana.
Yes, Carmina Burana, yeah.
Lanham began years ago conducting church choirs, and early on he served as assistant to legendary conductor Robert Shaw.
When you see him work, you see what he does. At one time he was trying to get a women's section to be a little bit more expressive in their singing, and he said to them, he says, you won't give yourself maybe totally to love, but at least you must be capable of it. And he got his point across.
I've heard you do things like that as well, you know, sort of try to paint an emotional image that you want the singers to translate into their voice.
Like we all do it, just try and get people to feel and understand what it is that you're singing about.
Now, with a little exuberance for, you know, for what you're doing. It so sounds so, what's the word, celibate?
It's a lot of work.
Yes, it is hard work. Years ago, it might have been a real athletic experience.
I don't know. It still seemed pretty athletic this time. I mean, watching you, your arms waving around, you'd be right down on the floor, right in front of the sections, and almost, you know, pulling with your arms, trying to pull their sound out.
Well, that's what you're trying to do. I find if I'm right in their faces sometimes, as I sometimes will say, oh, there's a little bit of a problem there, wasn't there, sopranos? And so let's do it again. And I go down and stand right in front of them. The problem disappears.
Yes, sir. Right in front of them. The day of the concert, the chorale members mingle in the basement of Sanders Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, alongside professional soloists and orchestra members hired out of Masterworks' small budget. An assistant does a final warm-up.
Right, not used to this, right? Let's try it again. Right, very good.
Before last words from Alan.
I was thinking as I was sitting in there and listening to people warm up, what a wonderful thing it is to sing. I want to see you enjoying it, not just hearing you. I want to see you enjoy it. Okay? Are you excited about doing this concert?
Yes.
Good. Well, you should be. I love to hear amateurs sing and see how that sound can change and how that understanding can change. That's what it's all about. Sometimes when I listen to tapes of our concerts, and I thought, gee, you know, they really sound pretty good.
There's something that happens. It's almost as if you're like you become like a human tuning fork when you hit it just right. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The overtones begin to be shared by everybody. And, when it really comes into tune and you can sense it, it is a very, very satisfying thing. Yeah? It just is a kind of a spine-tingling kind of thing when you have the sound that speaks like that.
Fabulous.
Thank you so much.
What a great piece.
The most important thing to me is to see the expression of the people, the singers, after the concert.
I love that piece.
Yeah.
I think it was the first year I came to sing with the chorus we did that song.
Is that right?
Did you do that 30 years ago?
Yes,
St.
I think
Bach
so.
Magnificat. I was in the chorus.
Oh, really? Oh, that's great.
How are you feeling about, you know, approaching some of the last concerts?
Well, it's a little difficult for me to talk about it because the whole experience has meant so much to me. I've had opportunities to go other places and do other things, but the Masterworks Chorale was the unit that kept pulling me back here.
I just have to tell you, my son is enjoying working with you so much. And
thank you so much.
Fabulous. We love coming to these guys.
I don't let myself think too much about it. I know I'm going to miss it, no question about that. I've had a full life and a long one in music, and I can't complain.
Just wonderful performance tonight.
Thank you so much.
Conductor Alan Lanham last fall. Tomorrow night, he will step up to the podium at Sanders Theatre in Cambridge for the last time as full-time conductor of Masterworks Chorale in a performance of Brahms' Requiem. His wife Anita in the soprano section, one of his two daughters as a soloist, and hundreds of grateful fans, former students, and choir members in the audience. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.